It's 6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Afghan leaders in Washington to discuss their country's future. Afghanistan's President Ashraf Ghani and Chief Executive Abdullah Abdullah held talks with top U.S. officials Monday at the presidential retreat at Camp David, Maryland, to plan for the future now that the U.S.-led NATO combat mission is over. Mr. Ghani spoke after those meetings.
The defense of our homeland is first and foremost our patriotic duty. Tragedy brought us together, the tragedy of 9/11. Now we've created an enduring frame of partnership. This is based on common values, respect for democratic process, electoral reforms, empowerment of women, education of girls, eradication of poverty. What are we doing? Not to be a burden, first of all, is to take control of our destiny.
The U.S. will consider funding to allow the Afghan National Security Force to remain at 352,000 force level through at least fiscal year 2017. They also agreed to require the government in Kabul to complete specific reforms and meet other milestones to receive up to $800 million additional dollars. President Obama released a video Monday calling for free and fair elections in Nigeria Saturday for Nigerians to reject the violence that has marred the country's previous election polls.
I call on all Nigerians to peacefully express your views and to reject the voices of those who call for violence. And when elections are free and fair, it is the responsibility of all citizens to help keep the peace, no matter who wins.
Mr. Obama said successful elections are key to stopping the insurgent group Boko Haram. President Goodluck Jonathan faces a tough re-election battle against his main rival, the former military ruler Muhammadu Buhari. This is VOA News. Saudi Arabia's foreign minister Monday warned it and Yemen's neighbors would take necessary measures against the country's Shia Houthi rebels if a peaceful solution could not be found to end their fight against the government of President Abu Mansour Hadi. Yemen's foreign minister Riyad Yassin also said Mr. Hadi has asked neighboring Arab Gulf states to intervene militarily against the rebels who seized the capital Sana'a in September and are now advancing south toward Mr. Hadi's base in Aden. The Houthis Sunday captured Taiz about 180 kilometers northwest of Aden. In Washington Monday, U.S. spokesperson Marie Harf acknowledged the situation is grave.
Further violence or any kind of deterioration further than this would be catastrophic for Yemen's communities, for the country as a whole. But we are being very clear that all parties in Yemen need to immediately halt all unilateral and offensive military actions, return to Yemen's political transition. I have urged a commitment to peaceful political transition consistent with the GCC initiative, the national dialogue outcomes. There are a number of ways they could get back to dialogue here.
The UN Special Envoy for Yemen warned the UN Security Council Sunday events were pushing Yemen to the edge of civil war. Forces allied with Libya's internationally recognized government in Tobruk Monday said they targeted a weapons depot belonging to the Islamic-backed militia near Tripoli, but a Libyan Dawn official said the raid actually hit a refugee camp, instead killing at least 8 civilians. Tunisia's Prime Minister Habib Essid fired 5 police commanders Monday in the wake of last week's terrorist assault in Tunis that killed 21 people, mostly foreigners. His spokesman said Mr. Essid found several security failures at the National Bardo Museum. Egypt, Ethiopia, and Sudan signed a preliminary deal Monday on sharing water from the Nile River, allowing Ethiopia to continue a construction of a massive new dam. Desalegn Meriam is Ethiopia's prime minister.
I want to assure the people of Egypt and the people of that of Sudan that this construction will cause no significant harm to the people of our 3 countries, and specifically to the people of Egypt.
Egypt, which relies on the river for agriculture and drinking water, is feared the dam would decrease that water supply. The son of Senegal's former president was convicted Monday on corruption charges and sentenced to 6 years in prison with a hefty $230 million fine. Karim Wade, son of Abdoulaye Wade, held several cabinet posts during his father's administration and charged with illegally accumulating a massive fortune. Pro-Wad supporters took to the streets in Dakar in protest, charging the sentence as part of a political vendetta waged by incumbent President Macky Sall. Ukraine has again accused pro-Russian separatists of violating the ceasefire agreement the two sides signed last month, saying the rebels fired rockets and artillery at military positions in the east. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, March 24th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigeria's main opposition party spells out some concerns ahead of Saturday's election.
If INEC is to be believed that the card reader will be used, the card reader will be effective, materials will arrive on time, then we have confidence in INEC.
Alhaji Lai Mohammed is the spokesman for Nigeria's opposition, All Progressives Congress Party. We'll look at the history of presidential elections in Nigeria. A new survey by Afrobarometer finds most Nigerians are dissatisfied with their elected officials. And Guinea marks first anniversary of Ebola outbreak with no apparent end in sight.
More than a year after the first Ebola case was discovered in southeastern Guinea's forest region, the number of new reported cases continues to increase.
That's VOA's correspondent Jennifer Lasutat in Conakry. A new report says that shortcomings of global responses worsen the Ebola epidemic in West Africa, and the FAO make global appeal to rebuild the agricultural sector in the Central African Republic. Those stories, plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. As Nigerians prepare to vote in presidential election this Saturday, a spokesman for the country's main opposition All Progressives Congress APC party says Nigerians will settle for nothing less than free and fair poll. Alhaji Lau Mohammed says APC has some concerns, including timely arrival of voting materials in opposition strongholds and no use of the military to intimidate opposition voters.
Our major concern is that Nigerians today would not settle for anything as in a free, fair, credible, and transparent election. See, Nigerians have gone through some very nightmarish experiences in the hands of this government in the name of elections. In particular, Nigerians remember what happened in Ekiti State, where security agencies comprising of military, police, SSS, civil defense, were used to thwart the wishes of Nigerians. The secret recording of Captain Kole exposed the shenanigans, and were also sickened by the fact that Nigerian soldiers, Nigerian policemen, and security agents can be used so blatantly to subvert the Constitution.
Do you or does have confidence, is confident enough that the Electoral Commission can administer a credible election, especially in the presidential vote this Saturday?
Well, you see, it's a tricky question. If INEC is to be believed that the card reader will be used, the card reader will be effective, materials will arrive on time, opposition parties will not be deprived of electoral materials in their strongholds, the military will not be used to intimidate voters, fake soldiers and fake policemen will not be used to intimidate and rig, then we have confidence in INEC. But if any of these fears of ours is not allayed, then we cannot be talking about a free and fair election.
Some people are saying, especially supporters of the ruling PDP, are saying that the APC should not be scared, so to speak, in this election because the APC said it has momentum on its side to win this election free and fair.
If anybody is afraid of our momentum, it is the PDP. The only reason why they postponed the election for 6 weeks was because of our momentum. They thought they could slow down the momentum. And they used those 6 weeks to throw more money into the campaign, really smear campaign. However, what we're afraid of is that this government is not remaining neutral. What do I mean by neutral? Federal institutions, such as the police and the army and SSS, must not be used to favor the ruling party.
Alhaji Lau Mohammed is a spokesman for Nigeria's opposition All Progressives Congress Party. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty, who is covering the elections in Nigeria. Nigeria's fifth presidential election on March 28 is expected to be the tightest since the country returned to democracy in 1999. But as Chris Stein reports from Abuja, that's not the only way this vote might be different.
From the balance of political power to the way ballots will be cast, analysts say a number of changes are in store for Saturday's vote. Disunity among opposition groups has helped the ruling People's Democratic Party, or PDP, to claim victory in the past four contests. But that changed in 2013, when leading opposition parties overcame their differences to form the All Progressives Congress, or APC. Analysts expect that party to present a major challenge to the PDP and their leader, incumbent President Goodluck Jonathan. While the party is a new factor in these elections, the politicians are not. APC candidate Muhammadu Buhari is very familiar to Nigerians. Mr. Jonathan bested the former military ruler in 2011 elections. But political commentator Chris Ngwodo says the PDP's nationwide support base, so crucial to its 2011 election success, may not be there this time around.
Historically, opposition parties have tended to be the regional parties and have lost national elections as a result. But for the first time, we're seeing a situation where the rules are reversed and the opposition party is now the national coalition and the ruling party has shrunk to become a regional party.
Mr. Jonathan is highly popular in the southeast and in his native southern Niger Delta region. In 2011, he won 99% of the vote in several states. The massive turnout for Mr. Jonathan, says Jibrin Ibrahim, a fellow at the Center for Democracy and Development, is unlikely this time due to better anti-fraud measures being implemented.
Almost everybody on the voters list as having voted for the president. In a real election, that wouldn't be possible. You don't get 99% turnout.
Ibrahim says changes in the way ballots are cast in this election will reduce ballot box stuffing and make the election fairer than before. But while there's a better likelihood the voting will be more transparent, the campaigning surrounding the vote has been markedly more divisive compared to 2011. Emmanuel Onwubiko, a retired journalist and head of the Human Rights Writers Association of Nigeria, says political speech was more restrained in the 2011 campaigning, possibly because President Umaru Yar'Adua had died in office just a year before. By contrast, in the months preceding this election, Onwubiko says politicians have shown no such restraint. And then there's Boko Haram. The Islamist extremist group was a problem during the 2011 vote, but it wasn't allied with Islamic State militants and wasn't the target of a multinational military campaign, as it is now. Boko Haram doesn't talk to the media, but has threatened to disrupt Saturday's election. Whether they make good on that threat is anyone's guess. Chris Stein for VOA News, Abuja.
A new survey by Afrobarometer ahead of Saturday's Nigeria election finds support for democracy remains the view of most Nigerians, but that view is tempered by high levels of dissatisfaction with elected officials. Afrobarometer is an African-led nonpartisan research network. It said it interviewed 2,400 adult Nigerians between December 5, 2014 and January 19, 2015 from 33 of Nigeria's 36 states. Nega Daniel Gondi is program manager at Clean Nigeria and Afrobarometer partner. He says elected officials, including President Goodluck Jonathan and members of the National Assembly, received poor approval ratings and were perceived by majority of Nigerians as corrupt.
What we found was that Nigerians support democracy and they prefer it as the system of government that they want to live under. But what was very surprising was also the level of support for some values that are not reconcilable with democracy. So, for example, we have quite a number who would prefer to live in a military rule, and then there were those who prefer to have a president who should be elected without a tenure limit, and also that they should have a president that is not subject to checks by the parliament.
Also, there's a very interesting finding about what Nigerians think about key political office holders. What did you find?
Analyze the question what Nigerians have a level of corruption, perception of corruption they find in office holders, and we were looking mainly at the officers who would be up for election, and we find that the legislature, for example, was considered, the National Assembly members were thought to be the most corrupt. And that was followed up by another finding that they were the least trusted. But we also found that the president and his officials were thought to be corrupt by quite a number of Nigerians, and approval rating was quite low. It was the governor, the state governor, that had a little bit appreciable approval rating among Nigerians.
Daniel, as you know, every study, people look for the reliability of that particular study. Why should Nigerians or Africans listening to this believe in this study that you've done, this survey you've done?
As far as opinion surveys go, I think that Afrobarometer is top of the range. We interviewed 2,400 Nigerians drawn from a representative sample in Nigeria. And we conducted the field work just in December 2014 and some of it in January 2015. So the data is very current. And the people we're working with are trained and they are very rigorous in cross-checking the quality of the data. So we are very satisfied with what went into the production of the survey.
Mega Daniel Gondi is program manager at Clean Nigeria and Afrobarometer partner. He was speaking with me from Lagos, Nigeria. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, March 24th. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 16 and a half minutes past the hour. March 23rd, yesterday, was 1 year since the World Health Organization declared an Ebola outbreak in Guinea. Jennifer Lazuta has more from Dakar with reporting from Zakaria Kamara in Conakry on what progress has been made and why the virus continues to plague the country where it started.
More than a year after the first Ebola case was discovered in southeastern Guinea's forest region, the number of new reported cases continues to increase. The World Health Organization says there have now been more than 3,400 cases in Guinea since the outbreak began, and nearly 25,000 overall in West Africa. The WHO says the week ending March 15th saw 95 new cases in Guinea, the highest weekly number since the end of last year. Spokesman Fode Tase Sila is with Guinea's National Coordination Unit for the Fight Against Ebola. He says today it is resistance that is preventing our teams from progressing and taking charge of this virus, so Ebola continues. It is no longer difficult to stop the outbreak. He adds everyone needs to come together and each person must take responsibility to defend Guinea from an enemy that is touching everyone. Social mobilization teams have been traversing the country for months, going door to door to spread messages about modes of transmission and prevention measures. Similar messages have been aired on the radio and TV, as well as on billboards throughout towns and cities. Despite some people taking heed, many continue to engage in risky behaviors, such as touching and washing the bodies of their sick loved ones, hiding suspected Ebola cases from health workers, and sticking to unsafe burial practices. Guinea is now equipped logistically to handle the outbreak, but even having the best response measures in place will only work if people trust them. Alusan Makanera Kake is Guinea's Minister of Communication.
Nous avons mis en relief la communication institutionnelle, la communication.
He says Guinea has put in place communication strategies and social mobilization teams because those factors contribute to putting a stop to Ebola. But he says customs, traditions, and conduct constitute the main reasons why there is still a chain of transmission. Kake added,
mais comme le président le disait,
the president has said it is easier to go from 100 cases to 10 than it is to get from 10 cases to zero. But Guinea still needs to follow the path to eradication. Authorities in Guinea say they will prosecute anyone who is found hiding a possible Ebola case or anyone who is caught traveling to another part of the country without papers proving they are Ebola negative. Jennifer Lazuta for VOA News, Dakar.
On the first anniversary of the worst Ebola outbreak in history, a leading medical group is decrying the missed opportunities for preventing the deadly disease from spinning out of control in West Africa. In a bit of soul-searching, Doctors Without Borders has issued a critical analysis of the global response to this crisis. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The report spares no one. Everyone comes in for criticism, including the authors of the study. The report by Doctors Without Borders, known by its French acronym MSF, is based on interviews with staff involved in the organization's Ebola intervention. MSF Medical Director Michaela Serafini tells VOA that in hindsight, it is now clear MSF should have mobilized its resources and response to the epidemic more quickly. She says the group probably held back from acting more decisively because of World Health Organization accusations that its warnings of the severity of the disease were alarmist.
They didn't take us seriously at that point in time, even though we have been working for quite a long time in Ebola, 9 different countries, 20 different outbreaks. We knew that this was different. The geographical location was completely different to the ones that we used to. The number of hotspots was different. The idea of this going beyond borders was different. So we really knew that this was an outbreak that was going to go out of proportions if not tackled correctly.
The epidemic that has been raging in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea has proved to be uniquely catastrophic. The Ebola virus has infected nearly 25,000 people and killed more than 10,000. These deaths include almost 500 health workers, among them 14 MSF staff. 1 year after Ebola was confirmed in Guinea, the report says an atmosphere of fear and the level of misinformation circulating in the West African countries continues to hamper the fight to halt the virus. Dr. Serafini says it is uncertain whether Ebola will remain an endemic disease in the area, but she adds there is a strong possibility that sporadic cases will appear from time to time.
Generally, and what we know is that whenever there is an Ebola outbreak, we generally have a second or third without knowing exactly the period of time between outbreaks. I do believe we are in a better position. I do believe there's plenty of lessons learned. So I do believe that there's quite a lot of knowledge that has been shared. And today we are much more conscious internationally about the disease.
Doctors Without Borders warns significant challenges remain before the outbreak can be declared over. It says there is no room for mistakes or complacency. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization says farmers in the Central African Republic are in urgent need of seeds and tools. Several years of conflict and violence has disrupted agriculture and created widespread food insecurity. The FAO is making an urgent appeal for more than $6 million to help rebuild the agricultural sector. VOA's Jody Capua reports.
The planting season begins next month in Central African Republic. The rains have started and the soil is rich and plentiful, perfect conditions to produce a bountiful harvest. The problem is over 440,000 people have been displaced in CAR's conflict. About half are displaced within the country and the rest are refugees in Cameroon, Chad, and DRC. Many of them are farmers. The FAO estimates about 1.5 million people are currently food insecure in the country, a figure it says is likely to rise without immediate support. Jean-Alexander Scalia, FAO's representative in CAR, spoke from the capital, Bangui.
The main help, you know, farmers need is really seeds. We identify more than 150,000 families, households, in need of seeds.
He says many farmers have had their seeds and tools looted.
Farmers just don't have even a single seed to plant for the next cropping season. When I say seed, it means, you know, mainly groundnuts, sorghum, maize, staple foods, and hoping that they will harvest enough in November, December for the family, which is something absolutely possible.
Of the 150,000 families identified as needing immediate assistance, funding has been received for more than 86,000 of them. But the FAO says more than $6 million is needed to assist the remaining 63,000 for the upcoming planting season. Scalia says pastoralists in northern CAR also need help.
They need veterinary drugs and vaccination for their animals and mainly cattle.
In March 2013, Seleka rebels toppled longtime president François Bozizé. Rebel leader Michel Djedodia declared himself president. From there, the situation deteriorated, with former rebels attacking mainly Christian communities. That led to revenge attacks by anti-Balaka militias. Djedodia was forced to resign, and Catherine Samba-Panza became interim president in January of 2014. But insecurity and violence remain in many parts of the country. This year's agricultural campaign in CAR has been planned by the Food Security Cluster. It's led by the FAO and World Food Program and includes about 70 other organizations. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
It's 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak After Sports News, we focus on the Athletics Gauteng North Provincial Championships in the South African capital, Tshwane. South African Commonwealth Games 200-meter finalist Akani Simbini won the 200 meters in a lifetime best of 20.27 seconds and 100 meters in 10.14 seconds on Saturday. Simbini surprised by his rich vein of form.
I wasn't really expecting it because my goal for Asian Championships was to just make the qualifying standard for World Senior Championships. Getting the PBs was just a good sign of where I'm at in my training.
Well, after the Commonwealth Games, when it came to Africa Championships, you were injured in the semi-finals. And so coming back straight away, it looks like the injuries you had were now a thing of the past. Are you fully recovered?
Yes, I've gotten over my injuries now. After the hamstring injury, I got a back injury. And then I got over that. So everything is back to normal now.
Having attained your initial goal of qualifying for the World Championships, for this particular year, what goals have you set in terms of time for both of your 1 and 200 meters?
For the 100 meters, it's to break the sub-10 barrier. And then the 200 meter, it's just to improve on the personal best that I have currently each time. That's just my goals for this year.
That was Akani Simbini, South Africa's Commonwealth Games 200-meter finalist speaking in Tshwane. Meanwhile, 17-year-old newfound Gift Lutella set a South Africa youth 200-meter record of 20.63 seconds. He later won the boys' youth 100 meters in a lifetime best of 10.47 seconds and is delighted.
The best day of my life. Just want to thank the Lord for his hard work and your everything.
You're a student, are you?
Yes, I'm still at Tuck Sport High School.
Well, didn't you feel tired coming into the finals and yet you still had to run your best?
I was feeling confident because of the time I ran in the semifinals.
So going forward, what do you think is your goal?
This year, I just want to go to the World Youth Championships in Colombia and bring back a medal to SA.
That was Gift Lutella, South Africa 200-meter youth record holder speaking in Tshwane. Finally, Africa Women's 400-meter hurdles champion Wenda Nell made a victorious start to her season in 55.20 seconds.
It was fun. I didn't put too much pressure on myself. Everything worked out. My stride patterns were perfect. Hopefully, as we go along, hopefully the time will drop.
55.21 is actually a much faster time than you started with last year. Could this be an indication that perhaps you may even go faster than you've done?
I really do hope so. 55.2 is not far from my personal best. My personal best time is 54.82.
And that means that even the South African record is under threat.
Definitely. That is my aim. Whether it's going to happen this year or next year, still a gamble for me, but I really want to achieve that.
That was Wenda Nell, the Africa Women's 400-meter hurdles champion speaking in Tshwane. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. U.S. President Barack Obama is calling for free and fair elections in Nigeria this Saturday and for Nigerians to reject the violence that has marred the country's previous polls. In a video released Monday by the U.S. Embassy in Abuja, President Obama says successful elections are key to stopping the insurgent group Boko Haram and allowing more than a million displaced Nigerians to return to their homes. That's it for this Tuesday, March 24th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as post-editor Mark Ouman, along with our engineer Carl Sterling and Jim Harriman, I'm James Barton in Washington saying, have a lovely day, Africa.
Next time on Health Chat, we will discuss tuberculosis with our guest, Dr. Louis Schreger, Vice President for Scientific Affairs with ARIS. Email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The U.S. country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call in during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Health Chat, this Tuesday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.